This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The history of the Cold War is getting rewritten as more documents from the U.S. and the former Soviet Union are made available to scholars. A good example is the recently published transcripts of Henry Kissinger's secret talks with Soviet and Chinese leaders. These transcripts reveal, for instance, that Kissinger offered the Chinese secrets gathered by U.S. intelligence on Soviet nuclear weapons. Kissinger was President Nixon's controversial National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, a position he also held during the Ford administration. The Kissinger transcripts were obtained by the National Security Archive of George Washington University, a library of declassified U.S. documents. The book was edited by the archive's senior analyst, William Burr. My guest is the archive's executive director, Tom Blanton. I asked him why the archive went after the Kissinger transcripts.
Back about 6 years ago, one of our staff, Bill Burr, who's a historian of the nuclear arms race, as in a response to one of his Freedom of Information requests, he got a fascinating, almost verbatim transcript of a meeting between Kissinger and the Soviet leader Brezhnev. And what was so remarkable about that document, he brought it in and showed it to me and showed it to other people around the National Security Archive. We had never really seen a memoranda of conversation like this. I mean, that's a term of art in the government, memcon. And usually, up to the time Kissinger came in with President Nixon, those memcons were more like summaries. So an hour-long meeting would take about a page and a half to summarize, and you'd get a sense of who said what, but it wouldn't be direct quotes. And what Bill brought in this transcript with Brezhnev was the almost verbatim interchange between the two. So you had the atmospherics, you had Brezhnev's little jokes, you had Kissinger being glib or laughing. And we hadn't seen anything like that, and it woke us up to this sort of new departure in government documents on the memcon variety, where Kissinger really tried to get a verbatim record of his conversations. So we decided then and there to go after all of his conversations. And we put together a chronology of all of his meetings with the Soviets and the Chinese, and then we started requesting all those under the Freedom of Information Act.
How unusual was it for meetings with leaders of other countries to be documented in a way that these transcripts documented those meetings?
In our experience, we found until Henry Kissinger became Nixon's national security advisor, it was very rare for these kinds of top-level meetings to have verbatim transcripts. You'd have a summary, a memcom, that would summarize what was said to each other, but rarely would you have either word for word or even less often would you have these kinds of parenthetical atmospherics, you know, Brezhnev stealing a briefcase or Deng Xiaoping spitting into a spittoon at the mention of the Soviet Union. So it was very rare. I think it's more common today because the government now understands how valuable this kind of verbatim record can be, just to know what our government said to those guys and what those guys said to us.
Well, Kissinger wanted these documents. He also wanted them kept secret.
That's right. He classified most of these transcripts above top secret. The label on almost all of them is top secret, sensitive, exclusively eyes only, which meant he and the president got to see them. We even have some memos in the files that show he would actually edit the transcripts for the copy he would give to the Secretary of State, if you can believe that.
Do you know why it was so important to him to keep these documents secret?
Well, the documents are really revelatory in the sense that the news, when this book came out in over the last month, the newspapers around the world have picked up the reality of the Kissinger relationship with the Chinese that he left out of his memoirs and that is extremely sensitive even today, which is the public picture of the time of this great historic opening to China was clever triangular diplomacy. Kissinger and Nixon playing the Chinese and the Soviets, the two great communist powers, off against each other for the U.S. interests. Well, it turns out when you read the transcripts, it's not an even-handed triangle at all. It's an all-out tilt to the Chinese. Kissinger at even one point calls it them tacit allies. He gives them intelligence on the Soviets, and then he lies to the Soviets about what he's doing with the Chinese.
Let's get into some of the specifics that you learned about Kissinger and China by reading these transcripts. First of all, he gave China intelligence that we had gathered on the Soviet Union.
That's right. It was from the very first set of meetings where Kissinger is trying to open the secret trips to China. He offers the Chinese as a kind of inducement, if you will, to let the Americans come to China, satellite photos and intelligence and warning and so forth about what the Soviets are doing along that huge, long border they have with China. And it turns out now we're beginning to find out from the Chinese side that some of the army marshals actually went to Mao Zedong in about 1968 when tensions with the Soviet Union were getting really intense. And they said, Chairman Mao, I think it might be time to reach out to the Americans because things are getting a little tense with the Soviets. It puts a little different angle on this. Maybe it wasn't the Americans playing the China card against the Soviets, but the Chinese playing the American card against the Soviets.
Well, Kissinger offered China a hotline, a nuclear hotline. What would this hotline have done?
There was already a hotline between the U.S. and the Soviet Union that was more of a crisis management arrangement. Came up after the Cuba Missile Crisis so they could have quick, instant communication in case of a nuclear crisis. What Kissinger offered the Chinese was a whole nother level of hotline. He said, yes, let's have real-time warning like their current one, but what we really want to do, and the secret part of that hotline, he says to Zhou Enlai, will be a direct line from our warning satellites that watch the Soviet Union to you, so if they ever move to begin to attack, we'll let you know before the attack happens. That was phenomenal. That's the level of warning the United States provides to NATO.
Why do you think Kissinger was favoring China over the Soviets during this period of the Cold War?
Reading the transcripts, you get the sense that he had a great deal of almost romantic attachment or illusion. He was very impressed with the Chinese. He writes about particularly Zhou Enlai, but also Mao Zedong in tones of almost reverence, where what he writes about Brezhnev and the Soviets, that they're obnoxious people there. They lie about everything. They're stupendous liars. He really seems to address Zhou Enlai and Mao as not only his peers, but in a bizarre way, maybe even his betters. And there's not that kind of awe, if you will, for the Soviets. There's the same kind of joking around and joshing, almost of a locker room quality between Kissinger and Brezhnev. And that was one of the revelations in these transcripts, to see Brezhnev kind of on top of his game before he had that stroke in the mid-70s that left him a kind of tottering, shambling wreck by the end. He and Kissinger joke about all kinds of things, cigarette lighters. Brezhnev makes fun of the way foreign ministers talk and so forth. But there's not that kind of when Kissinger reports back to Nixon and then later to Gerry Ford, Kissinger describes his meetings with Mao in tones that border on the attitude of a grad student toward a senior professor.
Well, Kissinger even tells Mao that Kissinger taught Mao's book in his class.
There's this wonderful moment, and it's in the historic first meeting in February 1972 with Nixon and Mao sitting in the study in Chairman Mao's residence in Beijing. And they start off the meeting with a little small talk. And here's Dr. Kissinger trying to give a compliment. He says, I used to assign the chairman's collective writings, meaning the little red book, to my classes at Harvard. And Chairman Mao says, those writings of mine aren't anything. There's nothing instructive in what I wrote. And Nixon says, wait a second, the chairman's writings moved a nation and have changed the world. And Mao says, I haven't been able to change it. I've only been able to change a few places in the vicinity of Beijing. It's a wonderful little moment because in the context here we have 1972. The Cultural Revolution had been going for over 6 years. Untold devastation in China, ruined lives, all because of Chairman Mao's attempt to keep the Chinese Communist Revolution from ossifying into a bureaucracy. He wanted a permanent revolution, but he was failing at that. And here he is in a sort of aside, a self-deprecating aside, admitting he hasn't really succeeded.
During one of the meetings, Kissinger says to Mao, things we can keep secret in this office, we can keep quite well, but there are no secrets with you about the Soviet Union. There's nothing we are doing with the Soviet Union that you don't know.
Isn't that a phenomenal assurance? I don't think I saw in any of these other transcripts Kissinger making that assurance even to allies like the British. It's a phenomenal bending over backwards toward China. There's this other moment where Nixon says to Mao, the chairman can be sure that whatever we discuss or whatever I and the prime minister, meaning Zhou Enlai, discuss, nothing goes beyond the room. That's the only way to have conversations at the highest level. Well, thank goodness for the Freedom of Information Act.
How much do you think that this was Kissinger trying to flatter Mao and the other leaders of China? And how much of it do you think was really straightforward?
Flattery seems to be built in to Kissinger's personality. If you compare some of these transcripts and the almost sycophancy in which he approaches Mao, there are remarkable parallels between that kind of glibness and flattery to the same way that Kissinger talks to Nixon and humors Nixon that we now know from the White House tapes. It seems to be, here you have this phenomenally brilliant, visionary, vain, ambitious, egotistical, flattering, deceptive, devious, manipulative guy, Henry Kissinger, and it comes through just overwhelmingly in his own words in these transcripts.
So do you think that Kissinger was as enamored with Mao as he leads Mao to believe, or do you think he's just flattering him?
If you can believe what Kissinger said to Nixon afterwards and what Kissinger wrote to Ford afterwards when he would do these summary memos for the president's eyes only, in those memos, Kissinger does say how astounded and in awe he is of Chairman Mao and almost in a way more so of Zhou Enlai. He really is amazed by them. And there's a remarkable psychology I just wanted to point out that comes through particularly in the Chinese transcripts, which is how this historic opening to China really kind of fit in with both nations' sort of collective psychology. From the American side, here we are, we're the adventurers, we, you know, open the Western frontier, we're going to Beijing, we're opening to China. It's very much part of our self-makeup, if you will, whereas on the Chinese side, their self-identity is we are the center of the world. We are the Middle Kingdom, and the barbarians always come to us and pay tribute. And that's what we did with Henry Kissinger.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, and he's the director of the National Security Archive, which is a research library at George Washington University, and it obtained the transcripts of the Kissinger talks, the top secret talks with Beijing and Moscow, and it's just published in the new book, The Kissinger Transcripts. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive, which obtained the secret Henry Kissinger transcripts, the top secret talks with Beijing and Moscow, and they've just been published in a new book called The Kissinger Transcripts. We've been talking about how Kissinger offered all of this intelligence about the Soviet Union to China, and he was favoring China over the Soviet Union. Did the Soviets, who Kissinger was also meeting with, have any clue about this more open relationship with China?
That's a great question. There is this wonderful moment in one of the transcripts between Henry Kissinger and the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, with whom he had a long-standing and pretty close relationship. There was a lot of mutual respect there. Right after Kissinger has come back from that first secret trip to China and they've announced that the trip happened and that Nixon's been invited to come, Dobrynin asked Kissinger, hey, are you, there have been some press reports maybe you're giving the Chinese intelligence about us. Are you doing that? And Kissinger just lies to him in a very clever way. He says, oh, Anatoly, do you think we'd be so amateurish as to do anything like that? And then they go on to another subject. Well, in fact, Kissinger was amateurish enough to do exactly that, but to spend a lot of energy misleading the Soviets. He was running a huge risk, I have to say. And that's one of the things that Bill Burr, our editor, points out in some of the commentary here, comparing what he said to the Soviets to what Kissinger said to the Chinese. It was a huge risk because if the Soviets had ever come to the conclusion and really realized how far Kissinger and the United States were tilting toward the Chinese, it could have put the whole process of détente and arms limitations and SALT talks and Jewish immigration from the Soviet Union could have put all of that at risk.
Now, you gave us some reasons why you think Kissinger might have personally favored the Chinese over the Soviets. But what about politically? He must have had political reasons.
That's right. And he gives a pretty good account of the difference between the threats, which is that China, the most populous country in the world at the time of this opening by this between them, China had probably no more than a dozen, maybe 14 or 20 intercontinental missiles that could actually reach the United States with nuclear weapons, whereas the Soviet Union had 1,000 or more. And the proportion of the threat to the United States was far greater from the Soviet Union. And there's this wonderful dance between the Soviets and the Americans throughout the period that you can read in these transcripts where the Soviets keep trying to kind of get the Americans in on a little joint venture to take out the Chinese nuclear capability. And the Americans never go for it. And the Kissinger keeps telling the Chinese, this is what Brezhnev really wants to do. And the Chinese are really wary. And in fact, as the period goes on and we get on to the 74-75 period under Gerry Ford, the Chinese are really getting upset about the success of detente. In fact, there's this one amazing attack in these transcripts from Deng Xiaoping, who went on to run China for the last couple of decades. And he attacks Kissinger for all his detente moves with the Soviet Union and compares it to Munich, where the West gave in to Hitler, appeased Hitler. And Deng says, you're just doing what they did to Hitler, and the Soviets are going to now attack. And Kissinger says, no, that's not what we're doing. So there is amazing tension all the way through about this remarkable relationship.
What do you consider to be among the more interesting things you learned about Kissinger's negotiations with the Soviets through the release of these transcripts?
The most remarkable aspect of the relationship with the Soviets, for me anyway, I had this picture of Kissinger around the table at the Kremlin going nose to nose with these tough Soviet communists about missiles that could destroy the world. And you get into the transcripts and you read what they actually said to each other, you find it's much less sober and serious than you might expect, and much more like even a locker room. At one point, you know, Brezhnev plays a practical joke and picks up one of the American briefcases chock full of top secret documents and waltzes out of the room, and all the Americans pop up and go racing after him. Hold on there, buddy. And he sticks his head back in and laughs. Or at another point, they remark, one of Kissinger's aides, Hal Sonnenfeld, had to see a dentist in Moscow. And so they start joking that the dentist managed to plant a microphone in Sonnenfeld's tooth. And then Brezhnev gives all the Americans some gift watches, Soviet-made watches, I should say. And they kind of laugh about that. And Kissinger said, oh, I see. The watch has a bug in it that'll pick up whatever the tooth doesn't. And they all laugh, right? It's an amazing, it humanizes this very Armageddon discussion about nuclear weapons. And what you get a sense of is how this style of joshing or joking actually helped them get past some major ideological barriers and national interest barriers to cut some deals, the beginnings of arms limitation.
Now, while Kissinger is talking with the Soviet leaders about detente and the Chinese leaders about opening up relations, Watergate is in the background. And how did Kissinger deal with Watergate? I want to quote something first. Kissinger's meeting with Mao at Mao's home in Beijing in November of 73, and Mao says, why is it in your country you're always so obsessed with that nonsensical Watergate issue? Such chaos is being kicked up because of it. We are not happy about it.
In that same transcript is a little parenthetical aside, which says that on the Chinese side, they're laughing as the interpreter tries to explain. She couldn't really translate the Chairman Mao's word for nonsensical, which in the Chinese version actually meant something like to let out air, i.e. to burp. The Chinese are totally baffled by Watergate, how a president who won in a landslide in 72, who was the architect of this major new alliance with them, the Chinese, could be forced from power a year and a half later. They are baffled. Nothing like that actually happened in China. Yes, Chairman Mao would have lower-level people purged. Deng Xiaoping got purged two or three different times in his career, but they have no idea about how in a democratic system, Congress and public opinion can work to take away the executive power.
When Chinese leaders were expressing their concerns to Kissinger about Watergate, what would Kissinger say to reassure them?
Kissinger actually agreed with the Chinese. He would say to them, you know, I don't understand it either. It's just a bunch of President Nixon's enemies. It's a political motivation. It's wrong. It shouldn't happen. He doesn't have a lot to say to reassure them, except that I'm going to stay. That is, I, Henry Kissinger, will make sure whatever happens with Watergate that our foreign policy stays on the same path. And that's the one kind of reassurance that he can make.
And he did stay.
He did stay. He stayed through Gerald Ford, although he had a much rockier relationship there with Gerald Ford than he did with Richard Nixon.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive, which obtained access to the previously top-secret Kissinger transcripts and published them in a new book. Blanton will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Blanton, executive director of the National Security Archive, a research library of declassified U.S. documents. The archive gained access to previously top-secret transcripts of Henry Kissinger's talks with Chinese and Soviet leaders. Kissinger was National Security Advisor to President Nixon and Secretary of State under Nixon and Ford. The Kissinger transcripts are published in a new book. Did you learn anything from these transcripts about what Kissinger really thought of Nixon?
These transcripts don't tell you except by inference what Kissinger thinks of Nixon. You see a lot of Kissinger's attributes on display, like in that first meeting with Chairman Mao in February 72, where Chairman Mao is trying to draw out Kissinger and give him a big compliment because he had arranged all of this. Chairman Mao says something like, "We've got to let Dr. Kissinger have a say. He's been famous because of his trips to China." And Kissinger very quickly deflects that and says, "It was the president who set the direction and worked out the plan." And Nixon then comments, "Henry's a very wise assistant to say it that way." And Mao and Zhou Enlai both laugh. And Chairman Mao says to Kissinger, "See, he's praising you. You're very clever in saying it like that." So you see one of the ways Kissinger got so far ahead is he was very careful to give Nixon the credit and to flatter his hosts, Mao and Zhou Enlai. You can see why he was so successful in a lot of these secret diplomacies.
Kissinger would try to flatter some of the international leaders that he met with and use that flattery in a way that was, he hoped, productive. But he was more of the backstabber, I think, when it came to his colleagues back in Washington.
Well, think about that very first historic meeting with Mao Zedong. And you and I get to be in the room reading the transcript. The Secretary of State at the time, William Rogers, did not get to be in the room. He was deliberately cut out of that historic meeting, not only by Kissinger, but by the Secretary of State's boss, President Nixon. There was this constant process, and we see it in these memos. We see multiple versions of some of these transcripts. Bill Burr tracked down in the files these memos from Kissinger aides like Winston Lord, where they would have a cover memo to Henry Kissinger saying, you know, "Dear Mr. Kissinger, dear Dr. Kissinger, or dear Mr. Secretary, or dear Mr. National Security Advisor," depending on his job title. Attached at tab A is the full transcript of the meeting for your file. And at tab B is a redacted, edited version, which I think would be fit to send on to the Secretary of State, for example. You see the use of documentation and the use of back channels as directed not even so much against, say, the Soviet Union, but against the enemy right across the Potomac in the Pentagon, for example, or the enemy right down at Foggy Bottom in the State Department. There is constant bureaucratic intrigue, and I think in retrospect, that was one of Kissinger's great failures. His insistence on back channels, on cutting out the bureaucracy, ultimately came back to haunt American foreign policy because, among other things, it helped break down any consensus even within the government, much less between Kissinger and Nixon and say the American people.
Now, do you think that he was trying to keep this information secret from other people in Washington for his own personal power, or do you think he just thought it would be easier to accomplish things if he were doing it without going through the bureaucracy?
I think both. I think it's very difficult. All of us as human beings rarely operate from single motives. It's usually a complex of motives. And there's this famous, maybe even apocryphal quote from Kissinger at some meeting or another where somebody, maybe Nixon, proposes a certain public statement about a controversial issue. And Kissinger says something like, "Oh, that would be great. It has the added value of being true." I mean, Kissinger kept these transcripts secret both because it made it easier to deal directly with the Chinese, because the Chinese were certainly keeping their version of the transcripts very secret. They were a totalitarian society. But he also kept these transcripts secret because they enhanced his power within the bureaucracy. It cut other people out of the loop.
Has reading these transcripts gotten you to reevaluate your impressions of Kissinger as a diplomat?
I think what the transcripts do is let you walk with Kissinger, sit with Kissinger as he meets with these statesmen, and appreciate this extraordinary combination of qualities: the vanity, the ambition, the brilliance, the vision, the jocularness, the flattery, the sycophancy, these extraordinary qualities that allowed him to build such relationships. And they really were relationships with such very different human beings running these extraordinary societies, where Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, Leonid Brezhnev, Anatoly Dobrynin, even Dr. No, Gromyko, the Soviet foreign minister. I gained a real appreciation of the quickness, the glibness, the smartness of Kissinger's ability on his feet, just reacting, how prepared he must have been going into these meetings, how he really gets what the other side is trying to say and turns it, as he can really do really well, to the advantage of the United States. I think in the long view, where the transcripts leave me, is a sense that where Kissinger goes wrong is not so much in these relationships with the Chinese and the Soviets. And in large part, I think history will look back and see the opening to China, or the Chinese opening to the U.S., as a turning point of the Cold War. It really changed all the terms of the foreign policy debate from a previous kind of locked-in anti-communist, anti-Chinese, who lost China mindset to a new, more interesting, more multipolar debate that's still going on today. And even the relationship with the Soviet Union, I think now we know from Soviet files, détente had a huge effect in really slowing down Soviet military spending, and in a subversive way, because of the cultural contacts and the greater interchange, really opening up a whole generation of Soviets to the West in a way that hadn't been possible before. And I think those things really did contribute ultimately to the end of the Cold War. But you wouldn't know it from the way Kissinger writes about the period, as if the United States was really on the losing end of the whole deal, because, you know, the fall of South Vietnam and Congress cutting off covert operations in Angola or, you know, wherever else. But, you know, the United States was much better off for the big picture. And Kissinger, I think, so overreacted to these, where he saw every little conflict as a kind of a projection of Soviet power, and in retrospect, it's clear that was wrong.
Now, do you think there's any possible harm that can come from the public release of these transcripts?
Now, 25, 27 years later, there is no harm from the release of these transcripts, and in fact, I think the transcripts make a very strong argument that they should have been released earlier. Because if we had had these transcripts back at the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre, for example, in 1989, I think the American public would have better understood why the Bush administration bent over backward and sent secret emissaries off to reassure the Chinese and, you know, did some temporary sanctions but nothing that was really permanent, or why Bill Clinton on the campaign trail in 1992 would criticize the Chinese and say, oh, we're going to beat up on you for human rights, but once he's in office, changes his tune. Because we, the United States, had a policy that was set in almost in stone that went back to the very first trip that Kissinger made to China, of an extraordinary level of military and intelligence and security and technological cooperation with the Chinese, which was a baseline that exists today and that underlines the current scandal over, are the Chinese stealing our missile guidance technology through our cooperative space arrangements? I mean, this was in place starting in 1971, and it helps, I think, all of us to understand why Tiananmen Square turned out to be a blip in the U.S. relationship, and why it is that I think the Chinese have come out so far ahead of the game. If you look at it today, the Chinese Communist Party is still in control of their state. They have open trade with the United States to the extent they've got a $40 billion trade surplus. They have this ongoing military and intelligence cooperation, and they have gotten away with massive repression of human rights without really losing or costing them anything. And that whole dynamic, that relationship, was the relationship constructed by Henry Kissinger.
Well, Tom Blanton, I want to thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure to be with you, Terry.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive, a library of declassified U.S. documents, which gained access to the top-secret Kissinger transcripts, which are published in a new book. Tomorrow, we'll hear more of the secret history of the Cold War. We'll talk with the authors of the bestseller Blind Man's Bluff about the secret missions of America's submarines during the Cold War. This is Fresh Air.